The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world. Just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We're kind of moving into the fall, and I know you listeners can't see this, but they've begun to decorate our Sirius studios for Halloween, and that makes us have this test. And what is Halloween? It's not all about the costumes or anything, but it's the eve of All Hallows, or the eve of All Saints Day. So to all of the listeners out there who are aspiring saints, I hope you're having a good week and getting ready to celebrate your feast day coming up in just a few weeks. You know, it's interesting. We talk about on Just Love that if we just love God, just love our neighbor, and we just love ourselves, it will make the world more just and more compassionate. I do think from our Catholic perspective, we're pretty good at understanding the need to be charitable. We understand the need to help somebody in need. We kind of really, really have taken to heart, I think, many people. You know that story of the Good Samaritan where somebody was kind of beat up and somebody helped him, and, you know, we don't like the people who walked by on the street and things like that. So I think, in our understanding of our Catholic faith, we understand the charity, the love, the helping pretty well. Not that we always do it, not that we're perfect at it, but I do think, you know, we kind of understand that piece, a fair amount. The other part of that, which probably we need a little bit more understanding of, is kind of that notion of justice, of trying to, you know, make the world a better place, not by helping an individual, but making sure we get it structured right, making sure that the parts are moving in the right direction, that people aren't left out, that people get a fair share, that people are respected, that they live in dignity and stuff like that. That's a little bit more complex. And it's one of the reasons it's complex, especially today, because, you know, immediately somebody says, well, oh, that's being political, isn't it? Well, maybe it is, but it's also part of what we need to do is our responsibility for trying to make our world more in accord with God's plan. So today, in fact, we're going to speak to that other dimension of making our society more compassionate and just. And we're going to speak about it from the perspective of, you know, how should we look about the world developing? What are some of the criteria we should use? And I'm just delighted that we have in the studio today two people from Fordham University in New York, a Jesuit university in New York, Henry Swabenberg, who is the director of the graduate program in international political economy and development. And we have a graduate student who is going to be a fellow in the next 6 months or so, Tess Hart, who they've worked together on developing a way for us to think about how is the world doing from a development point of view? How is it doing according to, you know, the criteria of what we need in our world? So anyway, Professor Henry Swabenberg and Tess Hart, thanks so much for being with us on Just Love today.
Well, thanks for inviting us.
Okay, so let's begin with you, Professor Swabenberg. How'd you get involved in all of this kind of stuff?
Well, that was a long time ago. I've been at Fordham, as you know, 29 years. So right. I had this interest in development. I had been overseas a little bit. And then I started to work closely with Catholic Relief Services, training students to work overseas. And I think that's how it started. Also, the papal documents.
Yeah, but you know, my real question, Professor Swabenberg, I mean, you're a kid from the Bronx.
Sure.
Okay. I'm from the Bronx too. I mean, you're not supposed to become one of these intellectual guys who kind of gets doctorates and then teaches at universities. You're supposed to do other things. I mean, how'd you get involved in kind of this area?
Oh, maybe that explains why I always want to make it concrete and practical and figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
I guess it was just fun. My family always were, actually, it's interesting. My families were uncles and aunts. They were always tradesmen, carpenters, plumbers, mechanics, but they always liked to read.
Okay.
So maybe that's where it came from.
Maybe it did. Maybe it did. Well, all right. So, Tess, how about you? I mean, now you're just kind of beginning your professional career. How'd you get interested in this? I thought everybody today of your generation is kind of going to get an MBA and they're going to make hundreds of thousands of dollars in the first year and millions in the fourth year. How come you're doing this type of stuff?
Sure. Well, I also would maybe blame my family upbringing, but I spent some time in Kansas City, where I'm from, working in the Catholic community there on justice issues, and just from an early age being encouraged to volunteer and seeing where these interplays of inequality come into our daily life. And from there, I went to a Jesuit school for my undergraduate and then became a Jesuit volunteer internationally. And so I took kind of those issues that I saw and put them in a more international context, and I was hooked from there.
So tell the listeners a little bit. So what'd you do as an international Jesuit volunteer? Where'd you hang out?
I was in Chuuk, Micronesia, which is in the Pacific Islands.
That's like far away, right?
Very far, yes.
It's not near Kansas City, right?
No, about 8,000 miles away.
8,000 miles. And when you were there, how long were you there for?
I was there for 2 years.
And what kind of things did you do?
I taught high school at a Jesuit high school there and was their college counselor and taught English classes.
Were you any good at it?
I asked my students.
She was terrific.
That is great. So anyway, so now listen, I mean, you guys, tell us about this kind of Pope Francis thing. Now, we all kind of know who Pope Francis is, and and so are you guys kind of trying to kind of capitalize on his popularity by, you know, building in this boring academic stuff by using his name? Is that what you're about?
I think so.
Oh, good.
So when he came here to, what was it, 2015, he was here for the UN? He gave a speech?
No, he wasn't. Because he was here to visit the immigrants and refugees.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Now I remember.
And by the
that's
way,
right. He went up to Harlem right. And then he came back. I remember.
And by the
and
way, we
the
let
side.
Him. And by and the way, this, we gave, let him talk at the UN.
And then on the side, he gave this little address at the UN.
Okay, so and I interrupted you guys.
No problem. We had to get that straight.
Okay.
And then at the UN, he said many things, but one of the things he said was, you know, I think it came from his background as a chemist.
Okay.
I think he likes numbers and indicators and measures and stuff like that. And he wanted to make it real. I don't think he likes ideologies, or he wants to see real people.
Right.
And so so he came up with these ideas that we tried to put numbers to. But the idea was that you had to provide basic needs of people. And he had four basic needs: water, housing, education, water, housing, jobs, and food. And then a lot of people do that.
Right.
Except he's more focused on basic needs, while other people a little more general.
Right.
And then what I think was new for him, he's also said people also need spiritual freedom. And then he went to define that a little bit, not totally, but a little bit. And he put in that category education, and he put in that category religious freedom. And he said other civil liberties, like letting girls go to school, so gender issues, whatever, a whole bunch of ideas. Right. And I think that second thing was the idea, we not only want to help the poor get their needs, but we want to help the poor to empower themselves and figure out and advocate for themselves.
So we're speaking with Professor Henry Swabenberg, who is the director of Fordham's Graduate Program in International Political Economy and Development. And we're speaking with Tess Hart, who is an international world traveler. And she's going to graduate from Fordham's program in International Political Economy and Development. And we're speaking about kind of measuring how well the world is doing according to core values, whether they be concrete things that people need of food and housing, or whether they be a little bit more spiritual things or things that deal with intellectual growth. So, Tess, listen, I'm not as smart as you guys, okay? So I just do a little radio show. I work at Catholic Charities and we try to help a few people. So tell me, how do we measure these things? I mean, what are we saying? I assume what we want is the world to be a better place,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
And if it's got more of certain things, it's better. If it's got less of them, it's worse, et cetera, et cetera. So in this index that you've put based upon Pope Francis's talk and maybe writings and things like that. Tell me and tell our listeners, so what are we measuring? What should we be looking at?
Well, I think it's important to pick the metrics that best explain what we're trying to explain. And so in Catholic social teaching, we have this idea
of... You know, if you're in academia, you got to use that word metrics at least once every day or they throw you out. For me and the rest of the world, that means, like, how do you measure it?
Yeah. Right. How do you measure it? So looking at, like, the idea of the preferential option for the poor.
Right.
And a lot of times in different indexes that we've seen, it kind of captures an aggregate, like an overall averaging, you know, rich and poor together. And in our index, we tried to pick measures that really captured what the basic needs of the most basic needs of people were, and maybe that were getting averaged into to other things, and we weren't seeing what was happening on the ground with the people in the most need, the most vulnerable.
So let me ask you a question. I assume one of the basic needs is water.
Sure.
Is that in your index?
Yes.
So is it binary? I know a few words. Is it binary? either you got water or you don't got water, or is it like you got a lot of water, you got a little water? Tell us how you measure that.
So we're measuring water based on the proportion of people who have access to improved water sources. So we're looking at whether or not they have a well that has a cover on it, or they have a piped sort of system to their communal area or into their actual home. So anything where it's improved, it's not just you're getting water from a stream which may or may not be contaminated, something along those lines. It's the proportion of people that have access to that.
Now, I think when part of the problem with all this research type stuff is that the conclusions are only as good as the information or the data that you got. So let's just take this water stuff.
Sure.
How reliable is the data that's available without spending 17 years trying to figure it all out?
Right. So we wanted our data to come from sources that were easily accessible to the public, but also from very reliable sources. So we took data from places like the World Bank or the United Nations or other pretty well recognized, established sources of this data. However, it does mean we are a few years behind. So our 2017 index is actually using 2014 data. So there is a little bit of a lag. But don't you
statistics people always tell me the best indicator of the present and the past and the future is the present?
Yep.
So it's probably not too bad.
Sounds good. We'll go with that.
Let's move a little bit further and say, so what'd you find out?
We got a lot of results. But what we saw was that when we compare what we saw in the Fordham Francis Index to like the United Nations measure, which is the Human Development Index,
right?
We had a few different results, largely because of our inclusion of the spiritual component, which is unique, something that they're not capturing, but something that Pope Francis and we would probably contend allow people to have like a better quality of life and be more agents of their own dignity, as he says.
Okay, so in the spiritual index, is it like, do I like God more or does God like me more? Is that what we're measuring?
we made it very basic so we could get a bunch of countries. So it was it was 20 different things all combined, wasn't it?
So for the religious freedom component, it comes from the Pew Research Center, and they're measuring restrictions that the government puts on religion, so allowing people to express their own religion.
And actually, on that particular one, isn't there also, there's a commission on religious freedom that's set up by the United States government, which also kind of ranks countries according to those things. Henry, so here's my question. Tess, like, did this recently and stuff like this. You've been kind of hanging around this type of information for decades, okay? Were there any things that kind of came out of kind of looking at data through the Francis lens, that index, that maybe you thought were maybe a little counterintuitive, or things that maybe surprised you a little bit or got heightened?
Sure, because when you look at a lot of numbers, usually, and it's on poverty, usually the focus is sub-Saharan Africa. And so so when we talked about water and housing, things like that, and food, we got similar results. Sub-Saharan Africa seems to be where a lot of folks are suffering. But when we started to do freedoms, such as religious freedom, then the focus moved away from Africa. Not that it wasn't a problem there to some extent, but it moved more to Asia. So all these countries that we thought were booming and doing well economically, when we start to look at spiritual freedom or religious freedom or political freedoms or civil rights, we got a very different picture.
That is very that is fascinating. Since Tess, you look at kind of the data in a new way. Any things that surprised you when you kind of looked at the data that were, you know, counterintuitive?
I don't know that I had a whole lot of expectations going in,
right.
But I do think that what kind of sets it apart from looking at the UN's like 2030 Sustainable Development Goals is that they don't necessarily address some of the things that the Fordham Francis Index picks up on, and I think that is surprising that these ideas of like gender equity or religious freedom and where that comes in terms of ranking a development situation. So.
Well, isn't that interesting? And to get kind of maybe broaden the conversation a little bit, I think when they talk about development goals, they pretty much are talking about kind of concrete, physical, economic development goals. And I would argue that probably one of the reasons for that, there's another, you know, ideological reason, but one of the reasons for, while it's hard to measure those type of things, it's really hard to measure some of the kind of religious or spiritual growth issues. So, sometimes, you know, you measure what there's data for because you can't look at other things. So that is an interesting thing to kind of broaden the concept to human development, and humanity includes a religious, a spiritual dimension.
And I think the UN is also moving a little bit in that direction with their new sustainable development goals. I think it's their 17th or something, but it's about just societies and good governance, and sometimes that gets into similar things of political freedoms.
Yeah, and some of the issues there, which we always have to deal with, is, you know, in some situations, depending on one's perspective, one's value system, there's like different perspectives. One could judge a similar set of data points, and somebody might say, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And somebody else might say, oh, that's not bad. I mean, for example, let's just give one that's been in the news very recently on kind of gender equity. You know, until maybe 2 or 3 months ago, certainly probably much of the world would have gotten a negative about women not being able to drive in Saudi Arabia. That probably wouldn't have gotten high marks on many indexes.
Mm-hmm.
Probably got high marks in terms of a certain group of people in Saudi Arabia who thought that was a good thing. So some of those things probably are susceptible to kind of a value system and a perspective.
Well, yeah. I think so, especially on gender issues. And that's why we are actually kind of trying to evaluate our measure of gender. And what we get the impression that the Pope is really interested in basic needs, basic rights, basic. And so I think we might be moving to a more focus on domestic violence, where we kind of all agree that this is something that should not be happening to women.
Yeah, and I guess, Tess, did you want to add something?
Well, not necessarily using the example from gender, but the idea of how you measure something, so a similar concept in terms of like employment and looking at that, you know, you can say the economy is doing well if someone's GDP is really high,
right.
But how are they using that money? With the FFI, what we're trying to do is see how they're using that money and spending it on those most basic needs, as Dr. S was saying. So that's an important differentiation.
You know, that is interesting. And I think you know, because, you know, you guys got to write papers and you got to do this stuff. There's a lot written on a lot of this stuff, and much of it is pretty good. I mean, some of it isn't, but much of it is pretty good. So that, like, there are these index, you know, the kind of the ratios of the, we try not to use initials here, and then I have to remember what they stand for. The gross domestic product, you know, the gross domestic product compared with how much debt a country has to pay off, because if they have to pay off the debt, there's not quite so much to invest in education or health and things like that. So that, you know, there's a lot of...
Similar to that, that's very interesting. What we looked at is countries that had similar income levels.
Okay.
And then we wanted to see if they came up different on the index, on our Francis index. And the answer was yes. You could have a poor country do much better than another poor country because they're more concerned about water and food and basics.
So I'm going to tell you, every now and then I read something. So relate all this to the Gini coefficient.
So
let me tell you, to our listeners out there, I show off every now and then. So the Gini coefficient is basically a measure that the smart guys like those in the room came up with to basically say, how do you measure whether there is a lot of rich people, where there's very few rich people, but really a lot of poor people, or you have a pretty thriving middle class and the extremes aren't so much. So it basically is a measure to figure out how disparate the wealth is distributed or the income is distributed in country. So anyway, that's what it means. So now talk.
Sure. So what we can find is like a country that's very much based on mineral extraction, petroleum.
Right.
They tend to have very concentrated incomes where only a few people benefit from the minerals or from the petroleum, and everyone else is left behind. But they can have high income. Another country who's developed more... where more manufacturing jobs, where more people have access to jobs and income, and they can have the same level of income, but the distribution of income will be very different. And the people on the bottom will be much better and will get a much higher score on our index than the other country.
Tess, you want to add anything to that?
And I think it speaks to what we're saying about trying to measure what Pope Francis is talking about in terms of meeting people's most basic needs and those who are the most vulnerable.
Right.
And allows us to see how a country is doing in relation to those people's needs, as opposed to holistically how its economy looks.
Now, interestingly, have you charted your indices against the more traditional ones that either the World Bank uses or the International Monetary Fund or the UN Sustainability Goals?
We have, and I'll let Tess give the answer, but we charted it against the normal economic measure of average income.
Right.
And then we charted against the thing that the UN Development Program developed, known as the Human Development Index.
Right.
And Tess, what do you think?
Well, we've seen that in some instances, the correlation, so the results from the Human Development Index and the results from the Fordham Francis Index, they do tend to move in the same direction. So countries that are better off in one tend to be better off in the other. But there are some disparities between that.
So which is the big one? Which is the big one that was like good on one and bad on the other, or bad on one and good on the other?
China might be an example.
Yeah, China's an excellent example, for especially the spiritual well-being side of the Fordham Francis Index, but that affected their overall score as well, because their economy is doing pretty well.
Right.
However, their restrictions on religious freedom pulled their score down significantly.
Gee, that strikes me as a really, really great example of there's more to life than just a thriving economy.
Yeah.
And that's good. Any ones we might be surprised that we say, oh, gee, that's a pretty poor country, but when you factor it all in, they kind of do better than on the Francis Index than they do on maybe some of the purely economic ones?
Yes. I just got to look it up quick. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Cameroon in Africa, on the... east coast of Central Africa, has about the same income as Haiti, but the gap is really big between the two on the Francis Index.
And who does better?
Cameroon.
Cameroon.
Well, yeah. Haiti with a similar income.
Yeah.
That means they, I have to look up more detail, right, whether it's water or food or housing or whatever it is, or religious freedom. But in some of those elements, Cameroon is putting their resources into those basic needs, yeah, while Haiti, it's being probably income distribution is, yeah, only going to a few.
So let me ask you a completely unfair question to academics, okay? But so I got to ask you this question. So what are you going to do with all this?
Well, I figured there's two things we can do,
okay,
with it.
One is you're going to come on my show, so more people know about it. Okay, well, you've achieved that.
Well, one is educational. Okay. So the students have a project. They, yeah, do it every year. Yeah. They learn all about these numbers. Yeah. They learn about development. They learn, yeah, about countries. So, yeah, that's education. Yeah. People can download the report, yeah, and do that. Yeah. But I don't think that's the reason the Pope came up with this idea.
Okay.
I think his thing was empowerment, and that he wanted civil society to be informed, so they could influence how policy is being done. And I think he felt that knowing the metrics, as we call it, the indicators of what's happening, may empower people to actually influence policy.
So we have a game here that we play in when we have these type of conversations in our last few minutes here. And this works really well. So Professor Swabenberg, you become Czar for a day.
Okay.
And Tess, you become Czarina for a day.
Great.
And if you guys could kind of direct the world economy and nations of the world, and no political ideology, you're the Czar and the Czarina, what are the three things you would do to improve the ranking of countries on the Francis Index? And I'll let you choose. No, I won't let you choose. I'll let Tess, you get to go first.
There you go, Tess.
Okay, great.
Because you can cherry pick. You can pick the easy ones.
And then I'll take it.
Okay. Well, something that we noticed in our research is that water is strongly related to some of the other things, like, right, access to education or quality housing. And so I would say that addressing people's basic needs for water is extremely important.
One, water.
Water.
Two. It's a lightning round.
Yeah. Okay. Also, I think that improving religious freedom in the context of civil liberties is really important.
Right. Two, religious freedom.
Religious freedom.
Three.
And three, education, empowerment with parity for gender included.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, we got three. All right. Now, Professor, you're smart.
Oh, now I got it too. Oh, well, she got the biggest indicator we found was water, so I'm just going to repeat that. I'm going to put in education there.
Okay.
Because I think part of stuff that we need to figure out still is what are the indicators here that are going to better influence the future,
right,
of people taking control of their lives.
Okay.
So I'm with education, water, and I guess I'll go with, I don't know, housing. Why not?
All right. Okay. All right. That's good. Now, you know, it's interesting.
Because housing relates to education for some reason.
I have to be careful how I do this because I know what I want to say, but I can't say it. Well, we had a guest on our show probably a few months ago who basically did the cover features article for National Geographic on the lack of places in the world to properly go to the bathroom.
Oh, sure.
And I can't say the abbreviation of that, but that was a cause of so much public health negativity in terms of diarrhea, dysentery, yeah, all of those things. That it was amazing. It was a fascinating, fascinating conversation because it's not one of those things that you think about. So
and it's very closely related with the water. The sanitation, yep, and water go right together.
Yeah, that's, and again, to bring it very close to home, you know, I didn't look this morning, but I looked yesterday, and I think as of yesterday, there was still the majority of. No, let me put it this way. The overwhelming majority of families in Puerto Rico did not have water that was safe enough to drink without it being boiled. Mm. And then there was a full 25% of the country that didn't even have water.
Mm.
So, you know, and that is an intriguing, that is
a devastating situation that needs to be addressed. So, okay, enough. I took enough of your time. Go back to studying. Go back to
making us. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
Thank you. Professor Henry Swabenberg, who is at Fordham University, Tess Hart, a graduate student there, and they have developed a very, very kind of fascinating Pope Francis Index of Human Development and kind of have ranked countries of the world using some of the basic facts that the World Bank has, the International Monetary Fund, but factoring in a little bit more than do you have enough food or is there enough water, but factoring some of the human development things like, you know, are girls being educated along with boys? Is there schooling for people? Is there the freedom to worship God? Is there those type of things? So it's a kind of a more fulsome look at kind of the human condition and the human person and human society, and to kind of say, hey, there's more to life than just enough food, good housing. They don't eliminate it, but there's more to it. So thanks for being with us, and best of luck. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just, then it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a moment or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
On the turning away from the pale and downtrodden.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world, and we try to make our world more just, more compassionate. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, we oftentimes focus on the compassionate, people doing good things to help others. But we also want to make sure that we don't overlook the fact that there's more to kind of our Catholic vision of the world than just helping people when things go wrong. There's a part of our world that kind of tries to see if we can't structure our world better to make things not go quite so wrong. And so this week, we're looking at some of the issues of development, which basically looks at, you know, how we kind of organize society so that basic human needs are met, and then we don't have to kind of always be focused on the charity and the compassion, because people are able to live in with the basic necessities and live in human dignity. And so I'm delighted that we're going to be speaking right now to our next guest, who is Jonathan Glennie, who is the director of sustainable development, director at the Sustainable Development Research Center in Ipsos. And we're going to be speaking about how
what human dignity means, what human development means. And I'm delighted that Jonathan Glennie has agreed to be on our show. Jonathan, thank you for being with us on Just Love today.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Great. So let me, a little background. How'd you get involved and how'd you get interested in the topic of sustainable development?
Well, that's an interesting question. I actually studied theology at university, you'll be interested to hear. And then I wanted to get into the world of international development. It was the thing that most, I guess, inspired me. I'd spent my gap year in Colombia working with street children. And I was desperate to get out and engage again in that field. So I did a master's in sustainable development in the late 90s, which was long before that, you know, that it became a ubiquitous concept. You know, you've got the sustainable development goals now, and everything in international development is hanging around that concept of sustainable development. Well, you know, I did my master's in it about 20 years ago now. And ever since then, I've kind of been working on that, you know, on that concept.
And so the research center that you're at Ipsos, tell us a little bit about that research center and what does it kind of look into?
So Ipsos is a global research company. We work in 88 countries around the world. My background is in the charity sector. I've worked at Save the Children, Christian Aid, and other NGOs. But I came to Ipsos to help them straddle their work towards the international development and sustainable development sector. So we work with big charities, with governments, with UN organizations in order to do research that they need to find out if their work is making a difference, to find out what kind of work they should do to improve their projects and programs. So they're really our clients, and we do research for them.
And you yourself, you are a columnist for the Guardian. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. I don't write for them as much as I used to now that I've got kids. But that's life. But yeah, I still occasionally put one out. And a few years ago, I was writing quite a lot for them.
So, what is your kind of notion that maybe sometimes we don't get the idea of human development as complete as it should be? So how do you think we should be looking about kind of dealing with poverty and human development? What are some of the things from your understanding that maybe we don't place enough emphasis on?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think looking especially the last 10, 15 years, I think there has been great progress, and I think that the evidence and the data backs it up. There's been a significant reduction in poverty in many countries, improvement in child mortality and maternal mortality. A lot of the things that we judge progress on are really improving. And there is a good news story, certainly, to tell the world, and which we should celebrate. But there is a kind of, I still think, a continuing problem in the way that we talk about development. And it still feels to me that it's very much what I want to describe as north-south. It's still a bit, we'll help them. What can we do to help you? And that's charity is a great thing. It's not to be scoffed at. But nevertheless, it can be quite patronizing as well. And whether that's international or charity on a national level, it can be patronizing. And so when you work with poor communities around the world or in your own country, you see that, and there's quite a lot of research to back this up, they feel grateful that people are working with them, and yet they also feel like they're being somewhat patronized. And they want to be respected and on a level. And so there's something that I think we need to do to kind of change the way that we view development, not see it anymore as a north-south piece of charity, but see it as work of solidarity. And everyone working together to achieve outcomes that we all want to see. And this concept of dignity that I wrote about in this piece is really a way of moving towards that understanding.
We're speaking with Jonathan Glennie, who is director at the Sustainable Development Research Center at Ipsos. And we're speaking about development. We're speaking about charity. We're speaking about dignity. And so Jonathan, if we were to kind of try to do or carry out what you're talking about, what would be different? How would we, if that North-South kind of model or paradigm were changed, what would the new paradigm look like, and how do we, how does that get carried out and implemented?
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that the how matters as much as the what. And I think that's not always considered in international development. So there's a lot of emphasis on quantifying progress, and ultimately often the ends justify the means. And I guess what we have to start to think about is whether that's always true. Is the loss of dignity a sufficient, an acceptable cost for progress? So this is great. When I started looking into this, there was this great story that I read by a researcher in, I think it was Calcutta, and he was working with a community that lived in terrible housing, and they were campaigning for much better quality of housing, and they were untouchables. They were the Dalit class. So a history of being ignored and outcast. And at one point, the local council eventually offered them better housing. And you would have thought, great, you know, if all you care about is actual concrete progress, then great, you know, they would just accept the better housing because they want better housing. And actually, this group said no. The community turned it down because they said, we haven't been involved in the discussions. You haven't treated us as equal human beings. Discuss what's best for us. So thanks, but no thanks. It's beneath our dignity. And it's an amazingly powerful thing for people to say that. And it's not just poverty and hardship that rules people's decisions. It's actually human dignity. And this concept of dignity is astonishing. And ultimately, charity can be bestowed on people. But you can't bestow dignity. That is something that is inherent in everyone. And quite often, and the fascinating thing about the concept of dignity is that the rich can be undignified. If you are living a rich life and not concerning yourself with poor people on your doorstep, then maybe it's not them, but you that's undignified. And that, I think, is a kind of turning of the tables that it's worth thinking about.
So in that particular example that you used, what was the next step?
I'm afraid I don't know what the next step is. I just read the research paper up to that point.
So
I'm assuming that they would continue their campaign for improvement in their situation on their own terms.
Okay.
And treated as equals in a agreement. And you see that across the international development sphere. So at the national level, you see the same thing. You see presidents and senior civil servants in Latin America, Africa, and Asia treated as if they need to come with a begging bowl, treated as if they are not at the same level as the World Bank or the IMF or even well-meaning charities turning up and delivering change, but not sitting at the table and participating in an equal manner. And it's noticeable, and it's deep within the psychology of people that for many decades and centuries have been treated as, frankly, lesser than and deserving of help rather than equals. And I think that that is a profound issue that now we have to respond to.
And it seems to me what you say is just so kind of self-evident, and you know, I've had on a guest here on Just Love over the years, we've had people who have involved in international aid, and you know, I would say almost to a person, at least in theory, you know, maybe it doesn't play out in practice, that people always talk about needing to involve the people in the countries where they are, in the projects that they're taking on,
trying not to kind of impose a different culture on them. So at least it seems to me, in many cases, the vocabulary that's being used by, you know, reputable international aid organizations speaks of trying to treat people with dignity. Like I said, if it's always carried out, I don't know that. So it seems to me at least the conversation has changed a fair amount in the past decades. Is that your experience also?
Yeah, it is. I think there's definitely changed a lot. And you may have heard of Amartya Sen, and your listeners may have done, and the way that he started to talk about development as freedom, not just economic and social progress. And that was a powerful step forward. And I think focusing more and more on dignity is a further step down that road. And of course, people who've worked in this field know these issues. I think where there's a tension is sometimes the way that we communicate these issues to the broader public, the way the government communicates its aid programs and the way that major international charities communicate. On the one hand, they understand this. On the other hand, communicating not dignity, but desperate need and the need for charity is often what motivates giving. And I think we need to go through quite a wholesale kind of re-education as northern societies to move on from the idea that we are wealthy and therefore able to bestow our largesse on the poor of the world, which is very far from the case, as you know. Very often we have been perpetrating injustices rather than responding to them positively. We need to move on from that lens, which is often the communication that we give, to one that responds to a history of unfairness, colonization, and injustice, and says, now we want to sit at the table and work together for global public goods. That's a very different way of talking. And you're right that it's something that's recognized within the community of practice, but maybe not in our communications. And the new Sustainable Development Goals are very much an opportunity to do that. So the South, the Southern governments were very powerful in insisting on the way that these goals were framed. And it's an opportunity now for the aid community to move on, probably to stop talking about aid, actually, and to start talking about investment and finance and support and mutual benefit.
And then you throw in the complicating factor. How do you deal with the fact that, you know, that oftentimes you don't have structures in some places that are able to kind of carry out some of the projects that need to be carried out? And you couple that with, you know, in all parts of the world, but at times the issue of corruption and things of that nature, it really is complex to figure out how you effectively kind of implement a program that respects kind of the dignity of the people who are trying to be whose lives we're trying to improve.
That's absolutely right. And the word you chose was absolutely spot on. It is very complex. And I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that, except to say that we have to understand the complexity. Right. So if you haven't got systems and structures and institutions in place that are able to really promote change, democracy, economic progress, etc., then it takes a long time to build them. Right. And advanced nations have taken a long time to build those institutions. And it's not going to happen overnight in countries where maybe they're growing fast, maybe there's more money around, but institutions take much longer to develop. So I think there's an element of patience there. And again, there's an element of kind of education of our own societies in the North about the reality of development and how complex and often long-term it is, and the importance of engaging in the long-term, not expecting sudden institutional change. Although, as I've said, over the last 10, 15 years, we have seen great strides forward in many areas.
We're speaking with Jonathan Glennie, who's the Director of Sustainable Development at the Research Center at Ipsos. And so, Jonathan, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to share with our
listeners the importance of dignity, the importance of investing in addition to charity, and maybe substituting kind of the concept of solidarity rather than a north-south paradigm on that. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
This is Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We'll be back in 2 minutes on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. If you want to know more about the topics that we discuss on Just Love, you can kind of check out my justloveblog.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at MSGRKSullivan. Monsignor K. Sullivan. So you can do that. Tom, tell us a little bit about news in the world. And, you know, one of the things I like you to tell our listeners about is how sometimes we get a little biased by our own world and the cultures and things that we feel very comfortable with in reporting on news items. And some of them get underreported because they're like out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, Monsignor, you know, on just in that vein, back on this past Saturday, October 14th, there was a major terrorist attack in Mogadishu, Somalia. 289 people were killed in two separate bombing attacks that took place in downtown Mogadishu. And it's interesting, Monsignor, because, you know, when you mentioned it, usually after a terrorist attack winds up happening, we usually see a lot of hashtag circulate, pray for, or I am, you know, for example, with the I Am Paris. But after these, you know, 289 lives were taken, the real problem was that the next day, that Saturday when the terrorist attack took place, between Saturday and early Monday morning, the hashtag I Am Mogadishu had only generated 200 tweets. But then by the middle of last week, over 13,000 tweets on social media were used to express frustration over the lack of media attention that was given both to the attacks and to the aftermath of people being concerned about it. So it was a major attack. No one has taken responsibility yet, but people believe it was the Al-Shabaab group that has been, basically combating the Somali government since 2007. They're an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. And to have that many people killed and to really have very little blip about it, I think is something that we should be mindful of.
You know, Tom, I think thank you for sharing with our listeners that item of news. And I think it's absolutely true. I mean, it's absolutely true. I mean, I can't speak about other parts of the world, but for those of us in the United States, we feel kind of comfortable with Northern Europe. There's a route there in which there is a lot of there's been a lot of migration over the past couple of centuries. And so we kind of have a natural affinity there. And again, I think there's a growing affinity that people in the United States feel with what goes on in the Caribbean and in Central America and maybe even South America a little bit because of the great number of people we have in the United States in different parts of the country from those areas. And you kind of tend to have an affinity. But I still think that the news on Africa is news that does not make the top of our consciousness. I mean, it may be buried on a back page or something like that. And so I think it's good that we here on Just Love kind of point out some of those items so that people, you know, do get a sense that the world is broader than we may think in our own world. And it's very, very interesting. And that's, you know, I would say it's one of the burdens and blessings of kind of our Catholic faith and our Catholic beliefs. I mean, we believe that every human being is made in the image and likeness of God, just not my neighbor who looks like me, not just someone who shares my own ethnicity, not only my own class. And, you know, it's one of the problems we have in terms of economics. I mean, you know, we want jobs for Americans, and that's critically important that there be good jobs. But it's also important that there be jobs for people in other parts of the world. And so sometimes there's a little bit of a tension between that because it's important that we realize everybody's made in the image and likeness of God. So thank you for being with us on Just Love. Learn more about what we talk about at justloveblog.org and follow me on Twitter, MSGRK Sullivan. Join us again next week. This is Just Love on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.